Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
I'm covering a part of the Torah portion, not all of it. I'm going to jump you into another area shortly afterward. So our Torah portion, though it covers all of Genesis 37, 38, 39, and 40, I'm only going to talk about two chapters in here, and I'm going to jump to one of the prophets section. So we'll start out in Genesis. This is 37 and 38. But the actual Torah portion goes 37 through 40, chapter 37 through 40. That's the full, complete Torah portion. This section discusses, obviously, those of you who are familiar with it, discusses, you know, Tamar and Joseph and Judah, as well as Potiphar's wife, and then the cupbearer and the baker. Although this is an important section, and the cupbearer and baker cover a lot on Messiah and how they are tied together in that imagery. That topic I'm not going to be talking about today. That topic is well discussed in a host of books and volumes about how the cupbearer's dream and the baker's dream and the 3 days counting cycle and how they tie into Messiah about the whole 3 days and dead and his blood and his flesh and all those combined together for Passover. That's what those dreams are focused on. I'm not focusing on them today. We're going to focus on two sections. It's actually part of chapter 39 as well. It'll be part of 39 as well. It'll be two sections regarding Joseph and Judah and discussing the ladies that they are involved with. Joseph and Judah and the ladies. Chapter 37. I'm going to read through part of this and I'll stop it periodically as we go through certain things. I want to grab your attention. So Genesis chapter 37, starting in verse 1. Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings, the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Jacob. Joseph, at the age of 17 years, was a shepherd with his brothers by the flock. But he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph would bring evil reports about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons, since he was a child of his old age. And he made him a fine woolen tunic. His brothers saw that it was he whom their father loved most of all his brothers. So they hated him. They could not speak to him peaceably. Joseph dreamed a dream which he told his brothers, and they had hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear, if you please, this dream which I dreamt. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the middle of the field, when behold, my sheaf arose and remained standing. Then behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." His brother said, "Would you then reign over us? Would you then dominate us?" And they hated him even more because of his dreams and because of his talk. He dreamed another dream and related it to his brothers. He said, "Look, I dreamt another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, 11 stars are bowing down to me." He related it to his father and to his brothers. His father scolded him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamt? Are we to come, I and your mother and your brothers, to bow down to you, to the ground?" So his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers went to pasture their flocks in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Your brothers are pasturing in Shechem, are they not? Come, I will send you to them." He said, "Here I am." And he said to him, "Go now, look into the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring back word." So he sent him from the depths of Hebron and arrived at Shechem. A man discovered him, and behold, he was blundering in the field. The man asked him, "What are you seeking?" He said, "My brothers do I seek. Please tell me, where are they pasturing?" The man said, "They have journeyed on from here, for I heard them saying, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" And so Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and when he had not yet approached them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Look, that dreamer's coming." So So now, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of these pits. We'll say, a wild beast devoured him. Then we shall see what will become of his dreams. Reuben heard, and he rescued him from their hand. He said, we will not strike him mortally. Reuben said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him. Intending to rescue him from their hand to return him to his father. And so it was, when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic that was on him, and they took him and cast him into the pit. It was empty. No water was in it. They sat to eat food. They raised their eyes and saw, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, their camels bearing spices and balsam and lotus, on the way to bring them down to Egypt. Joseph said to his brothers, what gain will there be if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, but let our hand not be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. His brothers agreed. Midianite men, traders, passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph back down to Egypt. Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. He tore his garments, returned to his brothers, and said, the boy is gone, and where can I go? They took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a goatling, and dipped the tunic in the blood. They dispatched the fine woolen tunic, and they brought it to their father, and said, we found this. Identify, if you please, is it your son's tunic or not? He recognized it and said, my son's tunic, a savage beast, devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to bits. Then Jacob rent his garments and placed sackcloth on his loins. He mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted himself. He said, for I will go down to the grave mourning for my son. His father bewailed him. Now the Midianites had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh, and the chamberlain of the butchers. We'll stop there for a minute. We'll continue our reading in a minute. I wanted to cover chapter 37 because it sets our stage about where Joseph is, how he got to where he's at. And now our Torah does an intermission, so to speak, or interplay story. So we're going to jump topics. We're left to Joseph hanging, so to speak, on a cliffhanger, to hold out, just wait, and pause his story. The next story, chapter 37, is going to be an insert. Now, it's inserted near the correct chronological time as far as our Bibles are concerned. But remember, our Bibles are not interested in chronology. It's interested in topic matter. They are subject matter dependent. You will notice there are periodically spots throughout your Torah that there are sections where it says this date, and it gives the date and time, which had happened before the chapter you just finished. So there are times that are not chronologically tied. They're not supposed to be. They're subject matter tied. So 38 and 39, chapter 33, are subject matter tied. But 38 is an interesting one. Now, mind you, though the Torah, this, how it starts out here in 38, it implies that after the time which Joseph was sold, chapter 38 then starts. That's not true. Chapter 38 started prior to chapter 37, many years prior. By the time Joseph is sold, the end of chapter 38 is then occurring in Judah's life. All right, so let's read chapter 38. So this is a going back in time about 20 years or so. Well, not quite 20 years, but in that ballpark. It was at the time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned away towards an Adullamite man whose name was Hira. And there Judah saw the daughter of a prominent merchant whose name was Shua. He married her and consorted with her. She conceived and bore a son. He called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son. She called his name Onan. And yet again, and she bore a son and called his name Shelah. It was in Chezeb when she bore him. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn was evil in the eyes of Jehovah, and Jehovah caused him to die. Then Judah said to Onan, consort with your brother's wife and enter into marriage with her and establish an offspring for your brother. But Onan knew the seed would not be his. So it was that whenever he would consort with his brother's wife, he would let it go to waste on the ground so as not to provide offspring for his brother. What he did was evil in the eyes of Jehovah, and he caused him to die also. And Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "Lest he also die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Many days passed, and Shua, daughter of the wife of Judah, died. When Judah arose and consorted, he was consoled. He went to his oversee his sheep shearers, he and his Adullamite friend Hira, to Timnah. And Tamar was told as follows: "Behold, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garb from upon her and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself up. Then she sat down by the crossroads, which is on the road toward Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, since she had covered her face. So he detoured to her by the road and said, "Come, if you please, let me consort with you." For he did not know she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me if you consort with me?" He replied, "I will send you a kid of the goats and the flock." She said, "Provided you leave a pledge until you send it." He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet, your wrap, and your staff that is in your hand." He gave them to her and consorted with her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and left and removed her veil from upon her, and she put on her widow's garb. Judah sent the kid of the goats through his friend the Adullamites to retrieve the pledge from the woman, but he did not find her. He inquired of the people of her place, saying, "Where is the prostitute, the one that crosses by the road?" They said, "There is no prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her. Even the local men said there was no prostitute here." She said, "Well, let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock. I really sent her this kid, but you could not find her." And it was about 3 months had passed that Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has committed harlotry. Moreover, she is conceived by harlotry. Judah, take her out and let her be burned." As she was taken out, she sent word to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." She said, "Identify, if you please, those whose signet this wrap and this staff." Judah recognized and said, "She is right. It is from me. As much as I did not give her to Shelah, my son, he was not intimate with her anymore." And it came to pass the time she gave birth to, behold, there were twins in her womb. And it happened that she gave birth. One put out a hand. The wife took hold of crimson thread and tied it on his hand, saying, "This one emerged first." And it was, he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother emerged. "So with what strength you asserted yourself." She called his name Perez. After his brothers, on whose hand the crimson thread came out, he called his name Zerah. I'm going to stop there for a minute and talk about a few things regarding chapter 38. Where did my marker go? I misplaced it. Oh, thank you. Okay, so we have an introduction to Tamar and of course, Judah's sons. I mentioned before, this event took place not necessarily the giving of birth, Tamar giving birth, but Judah's three older sons, him being married and them having three sons and raising them up, that took place prior to Joseph being sold to Egypt. And we'll explain that later. It's not complicated. It's pretty obvious. So Judah has a daughter-in-law Tamar, but first he marries a wife and has three sons. So he has Onan, and Shelah. So in these three sons, I want to ask you a question. How many have you ever heard, or has anybody ever heard in your life, of an evil human being? Right? And how many have you ever seen that God struck them dead? Big fat zero. So, how evil was for God to have said, "You're wicked, I'm killing you"? Now, mind you, God didn't strike Hitler dead, or Stalin, or Mao, or a lot of other people. I won't list their names because some people might be upset with me. A few other people that he probably could have easily done so, and our world may have been a whole lot better, but he didn't do that. He did strike dead. Now, Onan, he struck Onan dead too. We look at that and say, okay, yeah, what he did wasn't good, but really? Worthy of death? Honestly? I mean, seriously, of all the things you could do, was that worthy of death? Well, let's discuss this just a little bit. What Onan did was something which the Torah forbids, but the instructions what Judah gave to his son, Onan, are not in your Torah yet, because the Torah wasn't given yet. All right, now Tamar is a Canaanite descendant. She's a woman of the area. So this rule about, we call the brother producing offspring for his dead older brother didn't have any. Though we read about that in our Torah, our God's instructions, that instruction predates our Torah. It is a Canaanite instruction. It's in their culture. It could also have been in the culture of the Syrians where Abraham came from. I say it's a Canaanite culture, Canaanite instruction, because she obeyed her father-in-law's instructions, not remarry like an ordinary Canaanite could have done. So it must have been also accepted in their culture. So in what he did, the process why this is supposed to occur, theoretically speaking, is a one-shot deal. So obviously, God is trying. I'm not going to pretend to know what did to earn God's execution. Whatever he did, it must be pretty bad, because even Hitler didn't get that. Whatever he did was pretty bad. Onan, in the process of helping your brother's seed produce, in order to produce a child, you are supposed to go into his former wife until she conceives. Then you're done. Your job is finished. You go back to your ordinary life. You may marry or go, whatever the deal is. It's just till the job is done. It is not to seek your personal pleasure upon your brother's wife. That is not the functionality. That's not why you're doing it. So every time he went into her, what was he doing? He was using her for his personal pleasure, but then dumping it on the ground so that a child would not be produced, continuing to use her for his personal use. That is where you get an evil individual. He is what the Torah forbids. He is treating his brother's former wife as a concubine, essentially. That's not how it was supposed to be done. Now, for whatever reason, we can argue and debate whether that was sufficiently enough for God to kill him. It doesn't matter, because it's God's decision, not ours. But he then dies. This is where I want to get your attention. These two guys, whatever, who cares? It's the third son and Judah. Okay? So who was the girl? What was her name? Tamar. This is what I think is fascinating and why Judah comes to his brilliant conclusion. When Judah said, all right, Ur's dead, Onan's dead, he instructs Tamar to be in her father's household as a widow until Shelah is old enough. But his reasoning was that least he die also. She is a boy, yes. Least he die also. He was afraid Shelah was going to die also. So he sends her off to her father-in-law's household. Now, Shelah, of course, grows up. He's old enough to be married. But Tamar's not given to him. Who is Judah blaming for the death of his two earlier sons? Tamar. Who is Judah now punishing by a permanent life of widowhood for the death of his two sons? Tamar. Now, I have a question for you. If your children do evil in God's eyes and continue to live in their sin and become full-blown sinners of whatever worthy of death you can imagine, I don't care, do you feel any responsibility as a parent saying, oh, I wish I taught them better? I'll say yes, because I do. I'm assuming everybody else does. Now, if I'm Judah and I see was worthy of God striking him dead, Onan was worthy of God striking him dead, who should I be looking at? Myself, the dad. I'm the parent. What did I raise my sons to be? Where did I screw up? What could I have done better? That's where I should be focusing my attention on. What does Judah do? Point fingers. It must be her. She must be the cause. It can't be me. It can't be my sons. It's her. So he passed a severe judgment. And we think, well, how severe was it? Mind you, she is a widow, and she can only marry a descendant or an heir of Judah now for the rest of her life. Those are her only options, unless Judah and Shelah both die. Then she is free to marry again. But as long as a son exists, a relative exists, she must wait until an heir, she can produce an heir to continue on the inheritance that went to would have gone to to Judah's line. So she's stuck there until, essentially, she's released, either by marrying Shelah and producing a child, or producing some other descendant of Judah, same principle, hence the rest of the chapter we'll discuss later in a few moments. Otherwise, if that does not happen, the rest of her life, she remains a widow. Because she had no heir. That's how it's supposed to work. So this is where we're in this story of their culture. Yes.
Israel by that time,
yes,
right?
Yes, Jacob had already been renamed Israel.
In this story, he's called Judah because he's not being Israel.
Oh, no, hold on. No. This is Judah. Jacob is Judah's dad.
That's right.
Jacob is Judah's dad. This is Judah in this instance. What you're alluding to is when the Torah flips between Jacob and Israel on its titling, meaning what's going on in the story.
Good lesson about what names mean.
Yes, it is a good lesson because certain individuals, certain times, the Torah will discuss Jacob and cite him as Jacob and how he's either acting or what he's doing in his life. And at other times, it'll call him Israel, depending on what he's acting and doing in his life. One strives with God and one supplants, to take your own strength. There's two different ways of viewing it. And the Bible does use that periodically, not just in the Torah, but throughout its text, as discussing, it starts reusing these terms, and you can identify, not always, but more often than not, the humanity taking in charge or versus the God-focused individual. Yeah, directing the Spirit taking in charge. But that's a separate issue than what this is talking about here. So we have a base of what's going on in this story yet, right? Now, there's more about tomorrow we're going to study, but to study more about her, you have to read about Potiphar's wife. Chapter 39. I'm not going to read chapter 40. That's a separate, a new topic. And Joseph had been brought down to Egypt. Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh, the chamberlain of the butchers, a prominent Egyptian, purchased him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. Jehovah was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he remained the house of Egyptian master. His master perceived that Jehovah was with him, and whatever he did, Jehovah made succeed in his hand. Joseph found favor in his eyes, and he attended him, and he appointed him over his household, and whatever he had placed in his custody. And it happened that from the time he appointed him his household, over whatever he had, Jehovah blessed the Egyptian's household on Joseph's account. So Jehovah's blessing was in whatever he owned, in the house and the field. He left all that he had in Joseph's custody, and with him present, he concerned himself with nothing except the bread he ate. Now Joseph was handsome of form and handsome of appearance. After these things, his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he adamantly refused. He said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here, my master concerns himself about nothing in the house than whatever he has placed in my custody. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has denied me nothing but you, since you are his wife. How then can I perpetrate this great evil and have sinned against God?" So it was, just as she had coaxed Joseph day after day, so he would not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. Then there was an opportune day when he entered the house to do his work, and no man the household staff being there at the house, that she caught hold of him by his arm. She said, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand, and he fled and went outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called the men of her household and spoke to them, saying, "Look, he brought us a Hebrew man to sport with us. He came to lie with me, but I called out with a loud scream. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside the bed and fled and went outside." She kept his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she told him a similar account, saying, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came to sport with me. But it happened that when I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and ran outside." And it was, when his master heard his wife's words, which she spoke to him, saying, "Your slave did things like these to me," his anger flared up. Joseph's master took him and placed him in the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. He remained there in prison. Yahweh was with Joseph, and he endowed him with charisma, and he put his favor in his eyes, the prison warden. And the prison warden placed all inmates of the prison in Joseph's custody, and everything that was done there he would accomplish. The prison warden did not scrutinize anything that was in his charge, as much as Jehovah was with him, and whatever he did, Jehovah made successful. So in this chapter, we are introduced to Potiphar and Potiphar's wife. Now, to be, I wouldn't say word fair, but to be thorough, keep in mind that the term here is tradition. In verse 1 of chapter 39, it points out Joseph had been brought down to Egypt and Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh. What do your translations state? Most of you will probably say officer. Yeah. The Hebrew word there traditionally almost always is translated as a eunuch. So Potiphar as a eunuch of Pharaoh. Now, those of you who know what eunuchs are, how does a eunuch have a wife? Yeah, really. It's probably because he got married before he became a eunuch. So in this instance, now I do realize that, I won't use that side, not all texts translate things that way, but generally that word means is usually used as a eunuch. So in the case of Potiphar himself, it says him being an officer of Pharaoh. Now mind you, as you're an officer of Pharaoh, which means you work for him directly, you may be around a few of Pharaoh's lady friends periodically, because that's the nature of your office. So in which case, it behooves him to have you taken care of. All right? And it is an office to be raised up in. So in the case of Egypt, unlike some cultures, which you're born into an office, Egypt, only the Pharaoh was born into Pharaoh. Everybody else works their way up from the ground up. So you can be appointed as a friend, or you can work your way up by your predecessor not doing a very good job, and you just replace him. So Potiphar may have been fully intact when he got married. But through a process of time, being promoted to new office, he becomes no longer intact. Therefore, he is removed and potentially then a eunuch. Now, I want to bring another point to you, just so you are aware. Egyptian practices, which are recorded in Leviticus chapter 18, discuss a few relation behaviors that were considered acceptable in Egyptian society. So, it would be not uncommon for someone to go to Potiphar and say, "May I have relations with your wife?" And him saying, "Yes, you may." That would not be an uncommon practice in Egyptian society. You could not do the course to Pharaoh or Pharaoh's wife, but you could do that in a course to their wives. And it didn't matter, really, if you were a relative or not. That, of course, recorded in Leviticus chapter 18, discusses the greater details of that, which I'm not going to read the whole book today. But introduced to Leviticus 18, it does discuss these are practices in Egypt that you will not observe in your amongst your tribes, and it lists through all the different interrelations of father with a daughter, brother and sister, all the various actions which are done, mother and son, all those things which are not were not allowed. But in Egypt, they were practiced and considered normal behaviors. So they'll be surprised about the nature of Potiphar's wife and what she's asking for. It would not necessarily be abnormal or strange in their culture. Note, but Joseph did point out, you are the only one the Potiphar has denied. It means that at some point in time, Potiphar may have already told him, hey, this practice is common in our culture, don't do that to my wife. He may have already instructed Joseph that previously. We don't know. We don't know what was previously talked about. But now we have a general idea of the culture which Potiphar and Potiphar's wife are raised or growing up and living in. We have an idea of what the culture of Judah and Tamar in particular was raised up and growing up in. Now I'm going to ask you some questions. I'll see if you can figure out some answers. First of all, in our Torah, the conduct of Tamar and what she did, is that considered good or bad? Bad, right? It would be considered as bad. Oh, well, just we'll discuss it in a minute. We're discussing good and bad only, not just. All right. And it was deceitful in a lot of different ways. Actually, let's write a few of these details down. And some of the deceitful things she did, we'll discuss, because Judah comes to a very brilliant understanding at the end of that book, or in that chapter. So these deceitful things she did. Now, we're not discussing what she did with the sons, because it doesn't matter. We don't know anything. But, so, she pretended to be a harlot, right? Yes. She also pretended to be a particular kind of harlot, which is a temple prostitute, a religious harlot. So, a temple prostitute. So, a temple. Why do I say temple prostitute? Her face was covered. Her face being veiled means she's a prostitute. In their culture, Canaanite culture, the women were outside the temples as their pagan for use, and for the males to show how much they are grateful to the goddess of whatever it is that they're grateful for. And so they have relations with the principal prostitutes as if they're having relations with the goddess herself, right? That's how the temple pagan's idol system works. Yes, Deborah.
When you were saying that, a light bulb went on, and Ishmael, the Muslims, they covered their faces, and they, you know, I was seeing if there was a correlation as the harlot, because then, I don't know if you've noticed, thought that.
Yeah, that connection is very politically not correct. So be very careful who you say that to.
That would have been by harlotry. Because Isaac was chosen. Yeah. I don't mean it as them as a people, but I'm saying...
I get it.
There's a connection where the fact that if Ishmael was to be, which he was his firstborn son...
Through Hagar, right.
Hey, yeah, Hagar, that would be harlotry.
In a matter of speaking, well, Hagar was a concubine, so it's kind of a not quite the same as a harlotry. But your thought process is legitimate. It is legitimate. You have an interesting point. But I won't discuss that today. It's not fair because it's a long, long topic. Because it's a very long topic. But we'll discuss that sometime, some other time. So the nature she was a harlot, that is considered bad in our Torah. A temple prostitute, which means idol worship. So a temple prostitute allowed men, in this case was Judah, but the idea was men to help them worship their idol, their goddess. Temple prostitute process. And of course, obviously, she's deceiving Judah in the process. It's a deception, so deceiving. She deceived him. That's pretty obvious. And did she trick him or lie to him? Beyond the deceiving. Well, yeah, because she tricked him in the possessions that she got in a deal with the goat that was supposed to be done. So it was a small amount of lie there. That's not really major, like, death penalty lie, but the point is, it is still a lie. So she lied as well. So these natures, these things which Tamar did. Now, Judah comes along, and of course, Tamar is obviously pregnant. through these processes, the secrets she went through, Judah concludes that she is more right than he is, not because he had relations with her, but because he would not give Sheila to her. That was his reasoning. And we should think ourselves, should blow our minds. Are you kidding me? That's the reason? That's how you conclude this? Yes.
Yeah, I'm done. Could it be that, you know, he said to himself, I've been exposed? You know, I mean,
well, in that respect, I mean, yes. But look at his words.
Whatever way, he's got no argument. So,
Right. That is true.
Yeah.
But his reasoning was, do you recognize that he said, this is verse 26, she is right, it is from me. So he identifies that. He identifies from me. Inasmuch as I did not give her to Sheila, my son. So his concern, his major focus, is these are mine, this is identified, but she's more righteous, I did not give Sheila to her. That was his main conclusion, which is an interesting one. It should spark our imaginations. Okay, why is Judah making this type of conclusion? Not, it's from me, I did it. It's all my fault. No, that's not the conclusion. It's, these are mine, so it's obviously mine, but it's because I didn't give Sheila to her. Okay, Judah. As it was still a tip of fire. So he was concluding, he was deceiving. She used all these identities, all these issues. But Judah concludes she's more righteous. Her sin is less than mine because I didn't give Sheila to her. Now we look at that and say, okay, wait a minute. If I was going to put these on two scales and say, harlotry, idol worship, deception, and lying, your son was not given to her as a wife. Yeah, I would weigh the other things heavier. Because the Torah would execute this, a person, your execution for here. It's debatable on the deceiving and lying not, but both these are death penalties. This one over here, Sheila, the Torah doesn't give that as a death penalty. Because Sheila's allowed to refuse. He said, no, I really don't want to. So that's not a death penalty. I would normally think what she did was more unrighteous than Judah, but Judah realized something greater than this. Go to Hosea. Go to the book Hosea. Hosea. He saw something. Though the Hosea, of course, lives hundreds of years later. Hosea records a particular phrase in here. I want to bring this to your attention. Let's see, Hosea, what chapter is that? All right, Hosea chapter 3. And then we're going to also read a small section of Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 3 first. Chapter 3, we're going to jump to verse 3. Now, this is a section of explanation a little bit about the conduct. We're going to go through Hosea, focus on the conduct of the male and the wife or the girl, as opposed to the conduct of the girl. We're going to cover these verses. It's very important because Judah makes a realization. He doesn't use this statement, but makes a realization which justifies her over him. Chapter 3, verse 3, it says, I said to her, this by he's collecting a wife again, a replacement wife. He buys her. She's a harlot. I said to her, you shall stay with me many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man, for thus I will be toward you. The children of Israel shall abide many days without a king or prince, without a sacrifice or a sacred pillar, without an ephod or teraphim. After the children of Israel shall return to seek Jehovah their God and David their king and fear Jehovah and his goodness in the latter days. So we have this section that when you have a harlotry of a wife, you are not to know her and she is not to know any man. So in that instance, Judah's final conclusion with Tamar, after she gives birth, he never knows her again. He treats her correctly. To never know her, meaning have relations with her again. He understands that part. That part he does correctly. Jump to chapter 4, though. as to how he judges himself and realizes his error. So it's Hosea chapter 4, starting in verse, we do the first couple of verses, then we'll jump to verse 11. So Hosea chapter 4, starting in verse 1. Hear the word of Jehovah, you children of Israel, for the Jehovah brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed after bloodshed. This condemnation that Hosea is recording here is similarly repeated to God's condemnation of the people of Canaan. So when Moses comes out, so in Tamar's culture, this is not necessarily abnormal behavior. This is normal behavior, what she has done. But the Torah, it is an abnormal behavior. We do not accept such things. So Hosea is pointing out that Israel, you have acted like the Canaanites who once did with Moses' time. Now jump to verse 11, up to 4. Harlotry, wine, and new wine enslave your heart. My people ask and counsel from their wooden idols, their staff informs them. The spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray, and they have played harlot against their God. They offer sacrifice to mountaintops and burn incense in the hills under oaks and poplars and terebinths because their shade is good. Therefore, your daughters commit harlotry, and your brides commit adultery. I will not punish your daughters when they commit adultery, nor your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with ritual harlots. Therefore, the people do not understand and will be trampled. That was Hosea chapter 4, verses 11 through 14. So we have a viewpoint of how God sees this situation. So God saw Tamar's scenario. Said, okay, Tamar, you are now in widowhood. Judah has placed you there forever until you die. You're not coming out of it. And then she does this act to get herself out of widowhood. Now she has a reason to live. She now has children to raise. She has a purpose in life. And Hosea points out, in God's viewpoint, her acting this way in this actions is not a penalty against her, but rather against the one who caused it, Judah. Her actions were the result of what Judah did to her. And God points out, sins, which we may view sins, so-and-so sinned, it's their fault. How'd they get there? Because a God of justice doesn't just look at the action, looks why. How did it happen? How did we get to this situation? What caused us to come to this point? And all of that is weighed and added in. Hallelujah. Judah then realizes, look what I did to her. I forced a situation upon this woman that was unjust. I was wrong to do so. Judah realizes that. And he comes to the conclusion, she, though she did all these things, is more righteous than I am. Because I caused it. And as we learn from Hosea, God says, yeah, Judah, you did. It's your responsibility not to screw up and mess up somebody else's life, in this case, Tamar. It's very interesting. We understand that sins are not on the surface what they appear to be. They are deep. Sometimes they're strictly of our own pleasure and desires. Sometimes there are things we cannot seem to help or get ourselves out of situation. And God adds all of it up. There is a couple, you don't have to read this, it's not. I do not endorse it, but a philosophy, a Jewish statement, said God counts the tears of women. And we ask, why God counts the tears? Why? What is that for? He counts them against the man who created them. the man who induced the tears, who caused the misery. He said, look what you did. It's a Jewish philosophy. I'm not saying you should now obey that. The point is, it's a concept to realize my actions can induce negative behavior from somebody else and how they act to the people. My actions can affect you, which then can affect your whole life. Does that make sense? We all see that as parents, right? We as parents, like, I wish I raised my kid a little better than that. Oops. And we see how they repeat sometimes your own mistakes. Oh, I should have taught him better not to do that. My actions then affect that generation, which affects, it continues on and affects other people. Now, God obviously is compassion and justice and mercy, but we focus on, don't ignore the history of how someone got where they're at. Because truly, we're supposed to be judges, right? What good is a judge if he does not look at history? He's empty. He's a worthless judge. He'll make wrong decisions. Because he doesn't know how something happened. He may say, well, so-and-so, this is your first offense, so I'll be easy on you. No. Wait a minute. Look at history. Oh, this is the first time you got caught. That's a totally different scenario. Not your first offense. This is, you just finally got caught this time. You've done it for dozens of times. You never got caught before. Then the judge says, I'm throwing the book at you. You may have just been caught this time, but you actually are guilty from a long host of things you've done. That a judge has to look and examine history just as much as the current scenario does. That's what a just judge does. Judah runs across the same scenario. He now looks at, instead of Tamar's immediate what she did, he looks back and sees his own action to sons. Look at the history, how she got there. I'm the one who's guilty, not her. Make sense? Okay, yes, Larry. Go ahead.
Legal structure wouldn't catch that.
No, our industry does not catch that. It doesn't allow depth history to examine those things.
I was up on Facebook the other day, and I was listening to a story. This woman came before a judge, and she had her three children, and she's in tears because there's a ticket against her car that she cannot pay. And the judge was going over history, and he says, I see you have a ticket on this date, and then a year ago, I see there's another ticket, and then 5 years ago, there's still another, and these are not been paid. How do you explain this? And she told the judge, I didn't do it. It was my ex-husband. So he caused her to come to court, to come to tears. And so the judge asked the small child to come up and sit with him in his seat. And he said, what do you think we should do for your mother? And he gave her two instances. Should we penalize her and cause her great distress because someone else did this in her name? Or should we set her free? And of course, the little girl said, she should go free. And the judge set her free. So it is possible. He was a very kind judge.
Not all judges do things the same way. We have many different judges. They all do specialize in different things. That's an example of one that looked at history.
In that case,
he did the right thing. Yeah.
No, the guy did he was driving her car, mm-hmm. but he got the ticket.
Right.
So he could be, but our court would not take this guy, Judah, and say, well, Tamar did this and this and this, but you caused her to do this. That doesn't work in our court.
That does not work in
you
our court.
You did the deed.
Right.
Whatever happened before that, you could have, you know, no one forced you to do
right.
that.
Right.
You just, someone get put you in a situation where you thought that was the right way out, and it's not the right way out.
Right.
But the Messiah often said that.
Yeah.
My little ones must stumble, but woe be unto them that make them stumble.
Right.
For one.
That's a big
deal.
And
if you teach against the law, you'll become and encourage others to go against the law, then you'll be considered to be the least in the kingdom.
Right. So God, a true judge, a true judge examines deep history. We don't know these details, but I find it fascinating that Judah then realized the details. Let's go back to Potiphar's wife, because I want to bring out to her in the same scenario. Because we brought up both these women on purpose. So I'm going to go through every list of all these, how they're connected, but there's a few things I want to bring up to your attention regarding her actions and who that is against. So in Potiphar's wife's case, we understand that, okay, Potiphar, 90% chance, was a eunuch. He does not have relations with his wife. All right? The title is used for more often eunuch as opposed to official. Eunuch is a more consistent term for that, for what he's titled as. So he's a eunuch. She doesn't have relations with a husband anymore. Maybe she's younger, I don't know, but she doesn't have any more. So she is completely, essentially, celibate in the fact of their relationship together. Now, in Egyptian culture, at the time, unless you were Pharaoh, it didn't count, but if somebody else, you could ask or request use of another man's wife. And that was considered acceptable in their culture at the time. Of course, that's disgusting. You would do that. But that's what they did if the culture wasn't an issue. So in this case, her actions, was she a harlot? Was she acting as a harlot? She may not have been successful. We don't know. But was she acting as one? Kind of, sort of, maybe? Mind you, Joseph is the first one that apparently didn't work out. How many times has she done it before? Yeah. How many men are in the household? Apparently there's a lot of servants. She could have chosen any one of them. Maybe all of them. Who knows? Anyway, so she was acting, though it may not have been a very financially successful one, acting as a harlot. Was she using a temple or pagan idol type of harlotry action like Tamar was? No, this was not a worship's process. This was just a personal use. So in her actions were more of just for personal pleasure or use. I'll use the word use for that. Then did she lie about it when she obviously didn't work? She's tried it 3 times, of course. He runs away. She lies. Now, the lie would normally constitute as a death penalty in most cultures. Egypt, obviously, gets thrown in prison. Maybe the husband didn't truly believe her. I don't know. Either way, so she lies about it and ruins Joseph's life. Why do I say ruins his life? Are you ever pulled out of prison? Only when charges are dropped or your time is done. Family pays you the debt, somehow of paying to get you out of prison. Now, is Joseph's family going to come buy him out of prison? No. They didn't know he's there. All right? His father comes later. But there's a lot of things. When you're put in prison in that type of a culture, how do you get out? Either your sentence has to be defined, you're there for so much time. In this case, Potiphar threw him in there for attempted rape of his wife, as far as he's concerned, and who knows what else. That's what he's thrown in there for. There is no reason for Potiphar to say, "No, I forgive you." Until Potiphar does he ever get out? Who's going to try him? Who's going to put him on trial? you have kings that go through this. Unless the Pharaoh, who's the only judge of the country, unless he's going to bring him out, let's judge your rape case. How often Pharaoh's going to do that? Then Pharaoh kills his own men, much less worries about somebody else's actions. So Abraham called them? A place where there is no fear of God. So in Egypt, God is the Pharaoh. That is the only God. So the only way to get you out is if Pharaoh pardons you. Does Pharaoh even know who Joseph is? No. Pharaoh doesn't know who Joseph is yet. Not until after the steward tells him. Pharaoh doesn't know knowledge of him. Is Pharaoh going to hear his case? Not likely. What's going to happen then to Joseph? Unless something changes. He'll rot in prison. That's your job. Tell you dead. Enjoy it. Hope you have a good time. He's sentenced to death. It's not a very pleasant death. He's in a pit, a miserable place. Which the next chapter 41 or 42 or it discusses the whole pit thing, which we'll discuss at some other time. So in Joseph's case, though the similar actions, not the same, but some similar actions of harlotry and personal use, like Onan was a personal use action as well, and of course lying about it, all got his life destroyed, ruined. He's now in prison until he dies, until he rots. This is Joseph's existence. Now, unlike Judah, was Joseph responsible for any of this? No, he was not. Joseph was not responsible. He is a recipient of obeying God. But what does Hosea say when we read Hosea? It's very interesting. It said, I will not, verse 14, I will not punish your daughters when they commit harlotry, nor your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifice with ritual harlots. The people who do not understand, we trampled. So Potiphar's wife is acting somewhat in accordance with Egyptian norms, Egyptian culture. So who would God be upset with? Potiphar's wife or Potiphar? Think about that. Who is responsible for her life? He is. And is it acceptable in Egyptian culture what she did? Well, yes, it is. So in her actions, though the Torah says you don't do that, her actions are acceptable in the culture she lives in. Therefore, who's responsible for the culture she lives in? Pharaoh and the kings, the men who are in charge. They create the culture that is acceptable behavior on her. Who does God then hold responsible? The people who are in charge, who has said this is acceptable behavior. There's a reason why we pray for our leaders. We don't want them to destroy our culture in such a way that we become more depraved and more basic and more culturally or morally corrupt because our culture is considered acceptable. It's normal. Now, what I didn't discuss today is how God then deals with these situations. We'll discuss some other time. Because he has to correct both the individual people, but more dominantly against those who created the situation. How does he correct them? How does he fix this? How does he justify and say, hey, yes, your daughters tomorrow and your brides, Potiphar's wife, commit adultery and harlotry. I will hold it against you men, you leaders, you who are in charge, as the one that is responsible for it. So I want us to understand when we look at somebody who commits sins and transgressions and iniquities, it's not necessarily about them or what they did or aren't doing. Sometimes it's deeper than that. Sometimes it's bigger than just them. It gets larger. So we look at something and say, oh, that person did X, Y, Z. They should have done this. They should have done that. No, this is a bad way. You should go over here. Stop for a minute. Just saying you should go do or you should do this or shouldn't do that, that doesn't fix anything. How did they get to where they're at? Understand who they are. That defines what's going on. How can you come up with a solution if you don't know the whole problem? Otherwise, it's just a band-aid that fixes a gaping, festering wound. It doesn't fix it, it just covers it up. What good's that? You have to go deeper. Hence, we have a judge that goes extremely deep, deeper than any of us could imagine, who, as it says, does not judge with the sight of his eyes or the hearing of his ears. How do we must judge? We have to use our eyes and our ears. Only what we can see. We have to have a judge that looks deeper, okay, with righteousness and justice. Right? How do you get that? You have to know how the person got to where they're at. How the situation occurred. To condemn Tamar or condemn Potiphar's wife is unjust. They weren't the culprits of the major problems. Who were? the people who created the scenarios. They're the ones who say, if I don't act like Tamar or Potiphar's wife, that's great. But if I act like Judah did, or Potiphar, or Pharaoh, I'm worse off. So I am responsible not just on my own actions, but how my actions affect other people's lives. How it can either help them or destroy them. Those are also things God looks at. That's how we get a just God. One that truly sees through our pretty pictures, our facade, our song and dance. There is no song and dance. We discussed last week when Jeff was talking about up here that we have a judge that is comical, but described as one who does not fear God and does not revere men. He doesn't. He doesn't fear himself. He doesn't bias himself toward men. He truly judges complete depth, all history combined. That's the kind of judge you'd want. Because if you don't, somebody will not get true justice. Does it make sense? Hopefully it makes sense. Any questions about this? Yes, Larry.
Isn't it true that we don't really want justice from God? We want mercy?
Right. that's what I didn't talk about today. That's when it's mentioned that how does God deal with these scenarios, both the culture, the people in charge, and the individuals? How do we deal with that? How does God handle that? That's for another time. I can't cover that day. It's too much time. But yes, our goal is now we have all this massive justice. Uh-oh. Here's my laundry list. what do I do with that? How does God handle this scenario? What do we do? And that, of course, we'll discuss more at another time as far as how we deal with these scenarios. Any questions or comments? Well, thank you. We'll go into a prayer. We'll go ahead and close the prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you. For the Shabbat, our time of rest, our time of worship and praise, Father, please help us to be good servants, to follow you as best we can, to listen to you and observe and pay attention, to not judge the sight of our eyes or our ears, Father, but we'll let you judge and you decide and you guide. We praise you and ask your blessing in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.